Okay, folks. So this is Porrick from the Humble Coach Podcast. And I'm joined today by a friend of mine who is an adventurer. And his name is Gavin Hennigan. Gavin, thanks for joining me.
How are you, Porrick?
So, folks, we're having a cup of tea and we're going to have a bit of a chat about Gavin, some of his adventures. And I know this is a coaching podcast, so we're going to try and intermingle that in.
But I'm a coach. There.
But you are a coach,
I'm
exactly.
A CrossFit
level one. He's a CrossFit level coach. So it's going to be interesting to chat about that, and then also to how to kind of wrangle all of this into the crazy world of Gavin. So, Gavin, first off, give us the stamp, the postage stamp background for Gavin Hennigan.
Well,
if it's available even.
Yeah, I'm a CrossFit level one, so I'm the least qualified coach you've had on here. I've never actually coached anybody in CrossFit, I don't think. I just did the course in Melbourne, Australia a few years ago when I was out there. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to try and condense it all down, yeah. But I
so
suppose
don't condense it too much.
Yeah, like I don't know. I was making a Facebook page about 2 years ago, and it was like Gavin Hennigan, and I was like, what am I going to call myself? Because I can do like an athlete page.
Yeah.
And, I hazard to call myself an athlete nowadays. <Completely, yeah. laughs> You know, the wrath of exactly. Dara Boyle, like, you know. I know, we love you, man. So I just said adventurer that's I suppose what I am, and it was never really a conscious choice to be an adventurer. I still don't actually know what an adventurer is. Yeah. Actually, it's a pretty dubious job title.
Could be interesting for the taxman.
Yeah, exactly. So, look, I've just been, living life the way I want to live life over the last years. And, it's kind of got a bit of notoriety because of some of the things I've done, through my job as a commercial mm-hmm. diver, working on the oil rigs, and some of the kind of tough ultra marathons I've done, these cold weather ones up in Alaska. I did a couple of ultra marathons that were over 300 miles long, and then lots of other adventures and expeditions, been to all seven continents, snowboarding, surfing, trekking, climbing, all sorts of stuff. And then most recently, the thing I'm kind of well known for anyway around Galway is rowing across the Atlantic. So that's what I did. Actually just set off this time last year, I finished earlier this year, rowed across the Atlantic in 49 days. So that's nice. That's it in a nutshell for now,
That's pretty solid. that's a good start. So yeah. So I suppose like that, we can delve back into a lot of your story, but a lot of people are going to be quite aware of your kind of younger times and things like that, and some issues you would have had back in the day, and how you would have come out of them quite well.
Yeah.
And no, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of tough stuff back there, but I assume there's parts of that that you have definitely that have made you a much stronger human, so that you can achieve a lot of these.
Yeah,
these types of feats.
There's
been a decision made that you can do these kind of things.
Yeah, so
being
like
in a different situation.
Yeah, I mean, just to give a bit more background to the listeners, like I was most normal teenagers, I started drinking and using drugs, and well, I don't know if it's normal to use drugs.
No,
relatively normal, but I got kind of into it a bit full on, and mm-hmm. I have quite an addictive personality, so at 16 started into that and kind of spiraled a little bit out of control to the point where I was kind of using a lot of hard drugs. 18, 19, ended up kind of going over to London, kind of left Galway in kind of with the idea of never coming back, for a lot of reasons. And things just didn't really get any better living over there. I couldn't really hold down a job. I was kind of drifting around the place on the outskirts of London, just a really crappy existence through using a lot of drinking drugs. I was never I look back sometimes and I kind of think to myself, geez, I was never really like that hardcore, but it was pretty bad. Like, I was never injecting heroin, I was smoking it and doing crack and just crazy kind of binge partying and stuff like that. So yeah, like, it was some people think it's not it wasn't that bad, but it definitely was, and like, for me to end up in a rehab at 21, like, it had to have been pretty bad. That's what happened. Then I came back to Ireland, long story short, kind of like ended up getting in a lot of trouble at home again, was confronted by family, and you know, kind of had this realization, like 21 years old, I'd never finished school, you know, I'd never learned how to drive, you know, kind of wasn't a whole lot on my horizon really. So, you know, I kind of like said, you know what, I'm going to just give this rehab a crack and see what it's all about. And then I went in and spent sort of, you know, a month in this rehab in County Clare, and sort of, you know, was kind of introduced to this idea of abstinence, you know, because when somebody with an addictive personality, somebody who's an alcoholic or an addict, they generally, you know, if they have one drink or one drug, they're not going to stop until, you know, yeah, so one is too many, a thousand are never enough. So basically, I was like, right, I'm going to try and stay off it. But, you know, coming out of rehab into Galway, 21 years old, trying to stay clean sober.
It's very difficult.
Tough task.
Exactly. But
I was very fortunate, you know, a couple of months after I got clean and sober, or not long, actually, I met this guy, John, and he wanted to try surfing for the first time. Mm. So he actually was a DJ in the clubs. He was working like as, you know, in nightclubs, but he sold his gear because he was also you know, in recovery as well. Mm-hmm. So he said, like, look, I've got just a little bit of money. Have you got any money? And we can put our resources together and go surfing. And I said, look, I'm on the dole. I've got, you know, fuck all money. Like, this is. And so he said, right, I'll buy a wetsuit if you buy a board. So the two of us got together, pitched in, and we took off to La Hinch surfing. Mm-hmm. To give this surfing a crack for the first time in the middle of November, you know, so about 15 years ago. And of course, you know, we're down there, and he goes in first, you know, he hit first dibs, like, he drove, it was his car, and then he got in for an hour, and I'm sitting there in the car rattling in the wind and the rain, just kind of wondering what the hell we're doing. Brilliant. And then it came to my turn to get in, and of course I had to get into a wetsuit full of piss. And go in for a surf, and it was just, I suppose, in those moments, it was when I kind of realized that, yeah, this is kind of what living is, you know. And it was, you know, looking back, it was from then on that I sort of just was looking for adventure, or mm-hmm. for want of a better word, or just looking for something cool to do, you know. And surfing was that, and it was that for a number of years, and it just kind of one thing led to another, you know. I had a bit more of a passion and a drive, you know, and I had a reason to not go out drinking. It was to get up early and go surfing, you know. So I suppose, to cut a long story short, like, you know, to go back to your original question, like, you know, with my background and everything that I've been through, you know, I kind of have this very no holds barred approach, you know, because, like, I didn't believe in myself. I didn't, you know, I basically thought I was a piece of shit when I was 19, 20. Like, I lived in this flat in London, and, you know, there was like a mirror in the bathroom, and I literally used to just headbutt it every time I was in there, you know. And it was like, I didn't know why I was headbutting it at the time, you know. I was just like so frustrated and angry, and just pent up, and, you know, I just couldn't deal with my emotions, just all over the place, and I couldn't get life together. I just was a mess, you know. And it was all kind of, you know, like, alcohol and drugs for me is just a symptom of my problem. Yeah. You know, like, it's like, once you take that away, you need to deal with the sort of wreckage of the past, mm-hmm. and the person you are that's looking at you in the mirror. And that's the hardest part. That's why people, you know, have issues with trying to stay clean and sober, you know, because it's just easier to medicate, you know, you know. So so that's kind of, you know, that was been my sort of challenge over the years, really. You know, aside from all the crazy stuff I've done, is just to sort of, you know, be comfortable within my own skin, which is, you know, I suppose, for me, it's that's my ultimate sort of achievement, really. And, like, you know, I, you know, it doesn't matter how many bloody oceans I row, like, you know, the fact that I'm, you know, happy enough in my own skin, and I managed to, you know, not like take my own life and, you know, kill myself to alcohol and drugs, and, you know, make it out of that sort of dark time into, you know, whatever sort of life I have now, like, you know, I am grateful.
Absolutely. So I think that's a very honest but very straightforward and very solid answer, because when it comes to any of your activities, and a theme of my mentality towards you would be the concept of self-coaching, or at least not necessarily just going out or for any of these activities and having a coach. And you would have had, be it your family or friends like John or whoever it was, as your coaches. For me, it's never a case of you have a distinct individual coach that's this kind of guru or whatever it is that's going to take care of you. For me, like, I did a workout earlier on in the regular class in the gym that I work in, and the people around me were as good a coaches to me as any of the other parts of it. So there's never anything like that. And that's a really interesting point for me. in your kind of world, because having known you for a while and having seen you at different points, not necessarily any of the lowish points, mind, but a lot of the interesting points where it definitely looks like, from the normal person's point of view, that you're like this crazy person who's working on oil rigs, and then you're like surfing in Bali and you're doing this, and it just sounds like full on Richard Branson madness. But then when you actually are doing some of these very, very extreme events, the ability to self-coach or to self-organize, I find really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And the patience and discipline and the improvement of self-talk, which I think is really where coaching is at. For me, I should just be, as a coach, improving somebody's ability to self-talk.
Yes.
So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. No,
tons of stuff going through my head there. The first thing is, you know, I'm terrible at getting coached because I hate being told what to do. There's a reason why I still can't do a double under or a snatch despite being CrossFitting since 2009.
You can. He's like, you can do them really well.
No, I just tend to like...
Too busy rowing and stuff.
Yeah, I'm just not big on the whole, unless, you know, the whole train your weaknesses thing, unless my life really depends on it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? A lot of things in CrossFit, I kind of like, I could generally do them within the first few times of trying
exactly,
them,
like
pistols, muscle up, single that, you know? I didn't really... the whole coaching thing and self-talk and stuff like that. Yeah, I suppose going back to like that thing of what you're saying about, I suppose what I see is everybody can be a teacher in some way, you know, like a teacher to you. And it's about being like, you know, like you're the humble coach, you know, you gotta look for learning, you gotta look for coaching or learn, you know, being taught by everybody you meet. And my biggest teacher in my life was actually my dad. And that was probably my toughest relationship, because I actually, I pretty much hated him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he taught me, you know, when I was a kid, I just like was so angry at him because he wasn't around, you know what I mean? And I had all this like issues, and this is like going back to a lot of the stuff that I talked about with, you know, alcohol being a symptom of like the problems underneath. And for me, like I had a lot of issues with my dad, like, you know what I mean? And so, you know, what I say when I say that he's my greatest teacher, I say that like I had to kind of challenge myself to, you know, try and work that relationship out after I got clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of learned, I suppose, you know, the sort of compassion and things like that, and forgiveness, you know, through all this sort of stuff. And these are all kind of hallmarks of, you know, stuff that you need to have with yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I suppose, one of the most important things for me when it comes to, I suppose, what you call like self-coaching and things like that. Like, I think, you know, I don't see myself as being a terribly organized and disciplined person, you know. Like, I'm not terribly sort of motivated by the sort of trappings of, you know, the modern world. Like, you know, I think the idea of like a career ladder is the most ridiculous thing in the world.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, the accumulation of wealth is just silly. The, you know, the idea of, you know, getting a mortgage when you're young and a pension and just being sort of owned by the bank. You know, I just don't subscribe to that narrative of normal society.
Yeah.
I never have, you know. I nearly did a couple of years ago. I had money saved up and I thought maybe I will get a mortgage, and then I spent it all on a Russian rowboat.
We were getting worried for you. So we're like, thank God he's gone crazy again.
Yeah. I spent most of my life savings on rowing across the Atlantic. So yeah, look, I mean, as a saying, like that sort of discipline or that sort of coaching thing, I think it for me, I'm amazed at how I excel in a situation where, you know, my life is slightly threatened in some way, or I'm kind of up against the wall. And that's really where the sort of the fruits of are, you know. It's not sort of, you know, I don't feel like I'm terribly motivated, like I said, to do a whole lot in the sort of, you know, normal world.
Yeah,
but
no,
like,
no,
when it comes to like stick me 200 meters under the water in a situation where, you know, I'm looking out for the guy beside me, you know, we need to get a certain task done. If you do, you know, A and B wrong, then you're going to potentially kill yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you don't do this certain check, you know, and you're not, so if you're not 100% switched on, and I kind of find that like when I'm in those situations, I'm 100% on.
Yeah.
And then when I'm around here, I'm just staring at my phone and like, you know, I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah,
you know,
in a different world. Exactly.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, so that's kind of what I kind of I'm attracted to. Like, and people are like, oh, how do you go out into the Atlantic and all that, and how do you do all that? And it's like, well, it's kind of easy when you realize. Well, it's not easy. It's just like there's freedom when you get into a boat and push off from an island like off the coast of Africa,
and you go for it,
and you're like, I don't know when I'm gonna get to the other side. It could be 40 days, it could be 90 days. When that happens to you, and you realize that you have no choice but just to row, like things are a lot simpler, and it's really, really cool. I think that nowadays we're kind of inundated with too much choice in our lives, and it's too easy for us to dip in and dip out of things, you know.
Absolutely.
But like when you're put in a situation like that. And don't get me wrong, people have similar situations. Like I'm not telling everyone they should have to go and row an ocean. There's plenty of other scenarios you can put yourselves in. Yeah. You know, so, you know, I think that that's when I kind of thrive in that sort of realm of coaching, self-coaching, that, I suppose, self-talk, all that sort of stuff, you know. And it all comes from, I suppose, just a greater awareness of self, you know, and that's through, you know, all the years I've kind of, I suppose, like worked on myself and sort of, you know, kind of got through all my personal kind of demons, you know, from the alcohol and drugs and stuff with my dad, like dealing with the fact that I'm gay and, you know, that whole kind of stuff as well. You know, once you get through all that, you know, you've got a kind of better awareness of self, you know, you've got a better awareness of emotions, you know, on how you react to things. And you're sort of, yeah, you're in a better position to be able to sort of coach yourself, you know, but I think that's kind of important. Yeah.
Good stuff. So that's really interesting. In the middle of that conversation there, it brought me into something else into my head. And I would have always been a huge fan of this. And I think when I was a bit younger, I never thought I was... Like, I got into coaching when I was 15, 16.
Yeah.
But the concept of flow, for me, has always been a really interesting one. So the state of flow. And your story sounds... like a combination of a couple of things. Actually, I'm going to offshoot for a second.
Yeah.
I think I could be wrong about this now, so apologies if I am.
I think you're right.
But there's a climber called Alex Honnold.
Legend.
And as far as I know, and what I've read recently, and like a while back, is that there's a part of his brain that isn't, like, he doesn't have that part of his brain which experiences fear very well. So he actually can't physically experience fear very well.
Yeah.
So when he goes up, like...
El Cap.
Yeah, when he goes up El Cap with the other lads, and they're going, what the hell is going on here, dude? And he's like, I don't understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Like, this is just normal me kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, I think there's a great... Something else I saw actually there earlier on, and it literally is a case of your genetics, your environment, your upbringing, or at least your experiences, are going to build towards your ability to either express flow at certain points. So we'd say, for example, if you're at the bottom of the ocean, and which you've been on a number of occasions, and you have no choice, like you're in an extreme environment that you have, your body has to turn into a different lane completely, and it has no choice but to build, be it new pathways or new experience frameworks to actually handle all of this kind of stuff. So for me, that's a really interesting orientation towards, be it some of the extreme events you've done. Would you say you would have experienced a state of flow throughout a lot of those, or would that even be in your head to look at experiencing, or would you be aware of what it would be to you?
No, I totally nail on the head there, and thanks for including Alex Honnold anywhere near my name. Actually, I was in Yosemite like only a few weeks ago, and he was up on El Cap training. Yeah,
sad.
So he's
super,
he's,
super legend.
Yeah, he's a ridiculous. Yeah, yeah, no, that's really cool. That whole flow state thing is amazing. I'm definitely kind of interested in that whole concept, and
you're probably living it a lot.
Yeah, like I think that's essentially what I'm trying to do, you know, and like. You know, there's a lot there. Like, I think for me, when I look back over the Atlantic, it went by so quickly. When I, you know, it was 49 days, and it was, you know, a long, long time to spend on your own in a boat. You know, but it was 16 hours a day rowing, and you know, it did all kind of mold into one almost. But like when I remember before I set off, you know, I did an interview, and I was chatting to this guy just kind of candidly about, you know, the experience and, you know, how I was gonna sort of do out there. And I suppose I knew from my job as a diver, like when I go into the diving chamber, so I spend 28 days inside a little chamber for work, and I live, you know, we live in this small kind of you know, it's like the back of a bus basically. And then we go up and down in a diving bell every day. So we spend 28 days living in this chamber. You can't get out. Like, the only way you can get out is to do decompression. It takes seven days usually to get out. So it's not a case of just, oh, I want to go home. You can't go home. It takes
you're taking on
it takes quicker to come back from the moon, you know?
Yeah.
So basically what happens is, like, you go in, the door closes, and it's like you kind of like have this cabin fever. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, you go, you do your first dive, you come back, you get your sleep, whatever. And then a couple of days in, you start to, like, adapt to it. And then, like, after, like, a week, it's just kind of like your world. Obviously, you're thinking about getting out and you're thinking of, you know, the thing, but you're kind of in it. So, like, I've always been really kind of hyper aware of this sort of, like, adapting to an environment, you know, and just sort of becoming one with it in some sort of way. Now, you know, there's a million ways to adapt to a million different environments. Like, I mean, if I look at people today, like most normal people that are like go to work every day and they get stuck in traffic for an hour, like, they're adapted to that, even though, like, that would, like, drive me mad. But like, you know, and you can become totally kind of adapted to that sort of life or whatever it is. So that's kind of always the way I looked at it. And then that really is the flow state, you know, when you're in that, and that's kind of what I try and you know, look to. And, like, you know, so right now I'm sitting here and I'm going to Alaska in 75 days to do this 1,700-kilometer ultramarathon. Like, I tweaked my quad there, like, a few weeks ago. It's still not better.
Yeah.
Like, I can't actually, like, from here to there is like a massive chasm, you know what I mean? And, like, it's scary to me because I don't feel like I've done enough training. You know, there's a whole lot of insecurities going on, which is normal. But I just know from the stuff that I've done in the past that, like, you know, as long as I can get through the first sort of 48 hours, you know, that sort of, you know, that zone of, like, you know,
adapt to your,
you know, that shock, you know, and then you can start to try and adapt to the environment and sort of, you know, and that's when I know, and that's when I feel like I come into my kind of own. Like, I knew that going into the Atlantic, I said, the longer this gets, the stronger I'm going to get, like, which is not true, because I was physically, like, physically, I was, like, you know, falling apart, you know, I lost 13 kilos, I, you know, I was sleeping 3 to 4 hours a day, you know, I was, like, out of it.
Considerable,
like,
hallucinations.
Yeah,
like,
well, I knew that if I did get into hallucinating, I would be kind of over, you know, in the red zone.
It's dangerous,
because I did that before in the other ultramarathons. I can tell you some crazy stories about seeing stuff, but in that sort of zone, you know what I mean, where you're sort of just totally in it. So I'm looking forward now. I can see that I want to get in there. I want to be in that, like, because, you know, nothing else fucking matters, you know what I mean? Like, none of this, like, when do I have to pay that bill? You know what I mean? It's the same thing. Like, it doesn't matter what you do, you'll find it. Like, I mean, I, like, the whole, you know, I was a surfer, for God's sake. Surfers talk about the tube ride, you know what I mean? The kind of timeless moment, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, I've had that experience, and don't ask me why I'm not still doing it. I need to go back and do some fun stuff. I'm doing
serious stuff.
Yeah, I'm doing silly long ultramarathons and stuff instead of doing fun things like snowboarding and surfing. But anyways, it's, you know, you can find your flow state anywhere, I think, and it's totally accessible. And it's epic when you're, like, in it, and you can realize you're in it, you know, because it's always like afterwards or before it, you kind of, like, look to it and you're like, if I can just get into that. And that's always been my goal. So yeah, I can totally get that.
I think it's an interesting one as well, actually, on that, because, like, for me anyways, whenever I think of adapting, and I definitely thought of you on certain occasions, especially even with the likes of the rowing across the Atlantic, for me it's always been this sounds a bit of a strange movie reference, but in Castaway, when he's getting kind of bashed hard, he's trying to get off a fucking island, and he just can't get through that first wave, and he just gets busted.
Yeah.
But for me, when you, like, this happens in everything, like, it, obviously, and I'm always going to bring it, we're always going to bring it back to our own individual experiences, but like that, it has to be a case of get through the first couple of waves.
Yeah.
And then get your act together.
Yeah.
And then just go, right, well, look, that's fine, but I've always been a huge fan of trying to separate things out. So if something is done, then you have to actually move it. Like, you can't just leave it sitting in the background annoying you while you're trying to get other shit done.
Yeah.
Like, tell it, get out. Like, cut it away.
Yeah.
So if the past is gone, like, you have to learn from it, of course, but there's always going to be the remnants of it floating around that are going to teach you the lessons rather than just the actual baggage.
Yeah.
So for me, it's always been interesting to look at, be it very extreme adventurers or any kind of, even if you're just starting something, you're starting to learn how to play chess or whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's going to be that first couple of points where you have no choice but to accept it. It's going to be really, really awkward.
Mm.
And then try and go, right, well, look, this is actually now a game. I have to gamify everything.
Mm.
I'm curious if any of your experiences, and even the way you talk about the numbers, like I always find it interesting when people talk, when people who know what they're talking about start talking about numbers like that, we're really, really relaxed.
Mm.
I always find that really fascinating because it means that they're fully bought in. It's not that they're not bought in, like they're fully bought into it.
Yeah.
Do you think you gamify some of these activities to try and improve the ability to maintain them or the stability in them?
Like just kind of going back to your kind of the initial thing you spoke about there. It's going to happen a lot tonight. you know, this sort of idea of like, you know, putting stuff out of the way and like it, like the Buddhists call it like attachment, like a grasping, and that's kind of like, I mean, I'm a, you know, Buddhist light, you know. I like listening to some podcasts and stuff like that, but yeah, that whole idea of like grasping and sort of like this identity, this grasping to an identity and like sort of being defined by things, this is a huge point for me, you know, because, you know, like if you look at my life, like I've done a whole range of different things, you know, and I've not kind of really stuck to one kind of formula. I've always been like, oh, you know, I read this book about ocean rowing and then I went and learned how to row and rowed an ocean. Like it wasn't like, you know, so, you know, that's why I kind of look ahead and I think like, what am I going to do in 5 years? I don't know. I've got this kind of Alaska trip plan, but after that, who knows? And like, nobody knows. I don't know where I'm going to be in 5 years. Whereas other people, like, it could, you know, you're going to know what they're going to do in 5 years. And that's because, you know, they're clinging to this identity that like, I am whatever, I'm this person who does this particular job and this is what I'm good at, you know, and I try not really cling to that. I try and let go of, you know, sort of attachment and grasping to sort of any one idea. And that's really hard because, you know, we're always looking for security. Everybody wants some sort of security, like, you know, be it obviously financial, you know what I mean? You know, but, you know, this sort of identity security is a huge one, you know, and I kind of don't really, you know, sort of see myself as being any particular one thing. Like I don't, like, you know, people attach certain things to me, but I don't really think it myself, you know. I'm just kind of an open book really, and I try and be sort of open to new experiences and you know, so when it comes to, you know, sort of dealing with things, you know, particularly like you know, on the boat or anything to do with sort of rowing or the adventures, you know, yeah, I just sort of like, you know, just kind of don't overthink things and just think, what is the next kind of right thing to do? Like I'm a very much kind of live in the day kind of person, you know, and that's kind of how I did it when I was on the boat. Even though I was constantly jumping ahead, you know, I was constantly thinking, when am I going to get to the other side? When's this going to end, you know? But I'm just always like, I don't try and overthink things. I just try to be completely kind of like stripped down, you know what I mean? I think that's hard to do because, you know, like I said, you kind of want to have some sort of dialogue or narrative around yourself in some way. And, you know, I'm just always trying to strip that away, you know, and try and throw curveballs, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting. Going a little bit back to the CrossFit world.
Yeah.
A small bit. I know Rich Froning.
Love CrossFit, man.
Fucking love it, man. So we love Rich Froning. So
I do love Rich.
So Froning said on a podcast there a while back. I think it might be Barbell Shrugged. Fair juicy lads, good going.
Shout out, did you?
I'm not going to start doing this anymore, fuck it. So, it's my fucking show.
I've not listened to that one, actually. No. Is that the one on YouTube? They all said
It's good, actually. Yeah. But he talks about like the importance of training partners rather than coaches.
Yeah.
So, I'm agnostic to whatever we do on this show, or I do on this show. And for me, it's about like that. It's purely education, and people are going to get different things from different episodes, but would you subscribe to your ability to make better progress via training partners or via coaches, or at least not necessarily even coaches, but we'd say, for example, with rowing, like you had to get some help, a little bit of help, even with not necessarily rowing technique, but like the logistics actually rowing of an expedition and things like this. For me, all of this will be encompassed in a coaching context, so to speak. Which would you be more of a fan of, the training partners or we'd keep it more simple in the coaches kind of a scenario?
Yeah. First off, I'm a massive fan of Rich, and one of the reasons why I'm a fan of Rich is because he doesn't have like a coach, and he generally just does things as he feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that idea. You know, like I've had so many notions of doing like a, you know, a strength plan you know, sort of some sort of program like an Invictus. I remember getting downloading the Invictus program before and thinking, I'm going to do this. It's amazing. Like, you know, and I just never, you know, whatever. I'm just like, I'm not in the one place long enough. No. I'm not living a sort of normal life to be, you know, really able to follow something strictly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love that idea of, you know, just kind of going by feel, you know, just saying, you know, what do I feel like doing today, you know, and just going, like, I generally, like, I don't have issues with, you know, sort of, you know, pushing myself physically because I always bite off more than I can chew. So,
he always goes past the red line.
Yeah. So, yeah, like in that, you know, it's, I don't ever feel like I'm going to, you know, not kind of reach my kind of potential. I always like, you know, I always do an EMOM. It's like, you know, I'm like, I have to stop. You know, I always go like, shit, this is too much. Like I've gone kind of like, I need to do 20 minutes to say 24, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, so, because, you know, I'm trying to obviously stick with the quality and not be, you know, just trying to do X amount, whatever. But yeah, that idea of getting, I suppose, getting help, you know, it's super important. I'm trying to be humble and get help. And with the rowing in particular, like I didn't get a lot of very little coaching. Mm-hmm. Like my friend Henry, who helped me a lot with the row. He's a guy that I met like literally on the second time I was launching the boat down in Renville in Oranmore. And he just came up to me on the slipway and he was like, he started asking me like a couple of like technical questions. Now up until this point, everyone asked me like the real basics. They're all like, where do you shit? Where do you sleep? Like what happens when the fucking boat rolls over, you know? And he started like asking questions about the compasses and the navigation and stuff. And I was kind of like, this guy kind of knows what he's talking about. And I can't answer these questions. It turns out like he owned a boat there in the, in the marina, and he'd sailed the Atlantic, and he had been a rower when he was younger, and then he was really interested in the boat, and then he said to me, do you want to store your boat in my house? I live up the road, and I've been driving the boat across Galway, this is like a no-brainer. All of a sudden I had this, you know, resource. So you know, this sort of door opened, you know, for me, and it was, you know, it's one thing that I always talk about when I do podcasts or speaking engagements is like, you know, I kind of signed up for this Atlantic row and I didn't know what was going to happen. And then this door opened, like I got, the help is there, you know, it's like when you're afraid of doing something and when you think to yourself, like, geez, I don't know if I can do this. Is this going to happen? What, you know, and then you do it, like you don't realize that like doors will open. Like, so like as long as you commit to something, you know,
start the inertia.
Yeah, exactly. So this is my massive like door that opened. This guy became my ultimate teacher, really, you know, and sort of, you know, you know, I kept the boat in his house. He helped me with like a lot of, you know, the logistics and stuff like that. And like he was pivotal in me getting across. Like, you know, obviously I was solo in the boat, you know, and I was on my own for 49 days. But, you know, I was, you know, the paradox of that is that I got a huge amount of help. And I got help when I was out there. You know, I had a weather guy and I had Henry pretty much on the phone to me every other day telling me to do stuff because I was like so out of it, you know. So, yeah, look, I try and recognize, you know, these sort of these people when they're put in front of me, really, or when they sort of turn up, you know. And then to go back to the training part of the thing, like when it comes to that, like, yeah, I love training with other people. You know, I love, like, obviously whenever I do make it to a CrossFit class, like the group dynamic, you know, but I have to be careful because I'm a complete knucklehead and I'm super competitive. So like, it's funny. I actually just realized as well that I can't, I used to do this thing where I said, right, cause I do like adventure races and ultramarathons and stuff like that. And I said, I always used to say, oh, I'm just going to do this race as training. Like bollocks. Exactly. Bollocks. Like it's just like it never happens.
It always goes.
Yeah, it's like you take off and then there's some guy ahead and you're like, fuck that. I don't know. Get away from me. You know what I mean?
This isn't gonna happen.
Yeah. So that's the end. Like kind of, you know. So that's But like training partners. I just got to watch myself. But it's like, you know,
it's very valuable.
I've trained with Ronan, you know, Ronan Graham over the years, a lot of CrossFit with him. My other friend Brian, Peter, we go mountain running and stuff like that, you know. I don't do it enough, to be quite honest. Like I do, like I'm too comfortable on my own, you know. Joined a cycling club recently. There's one I was doing sort of Sunday morning cycles and stuff like that, so starting to be a bit more social. Like, you know, I gotta watch myself because
don't get too social.
This
is the key. This is a huge point, like, because like that the next race you're doing, how long will that take potentially? So how long are you anticipating it to take?
So it's going to be like, the cutoff is 35 days.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So this is the thing. So this is exactly. So you can't get too social. Like, obviously, like, it's good that you don't drink over Christmas. You'd be screwed. Like, you'd be just living the dream and just like enjoying life too much.
Yeah, I'd start training after Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, then everyone else is, that, you know, the kind of situation with that. But that's a really interesting point, because you have to nearly adapt to a little bit of solitude.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's the thing. You gotta be comfortable, you know, being on your own and sort of making these decisions on my own. Like, when I first started in the boat, like, I was always taking somebody out with me, and I actually had photos that I posted online. I had to get one of the lads photoshopped out of there, because, like, I was too, you know. And then I was a couple of months, you know, this is a good month, six weeks after I started training, I was like, I need to go out on my own. It was quite daunting to kind of, because obviously you think about, you're in this big boat and you're sat backwards and you're trying to get out of a marina, you can't see where you're going. So I did have a mirror, and I was kind of like banging off some of the boats down in the marina there. So, but it's important to balance it out, really, and sort of, like, you know, definitely, you know, be social, train with people, but to sort of, you know, go out there on your own and be able to motivate yourself to do things and make decisions on your own, you know, because it ultimately comes back to that, comes back to decision making. And the next race, though, is a bit different in that.
So you're doing the, what's the race called?
It's called the Iditarod. So it's a race on the Iditarod Trail. The Iditarod Trail is an old historic trail that crosses Alaska. It goes from just outside Anchorage to Nome on the Bering Sea. In wintertime, this trail is very active because this huge section of Alaska, there's no roads, basically, and there's a whole bunch of villages on the rivers and stuff like that and in the mountains, and they're not really accessible in the summer because this trail is kind of swamped in and stuff like that. But then it all freezes over, the snow in the winter, and people can get along on snowmobiles and on dog sleds, so there's access to the villages. But the main thing the trail is famous for is the Iditarod dog sled race. So that's on every year. It's been going on for, I don't know, like, probably 100 years. It's really famous. And that happens every year, and, like, there's a bit of a sideshow, which is
your race.
people who do it on foot, or else on ski or on bike. Now, not very many people do it on ski or on foot. Most people do it on bike. You know, the fat bikes, which is definitely a cool way to do it. It's a lot quicker.
It's very cool.
But so it's 1,700 kilometers, like, across Alaska. It intersects these little villages. It kind of crosses the mountains, it goes on rivers, it crosses goes along coastline all up to Nome. You end up crossing like a 50-mile section of sea ice. Yeah, it's like a ridiculous challenge. It's been run kind of on and off for like 20 years, and like only 20 people have managed to get to the finish line. Like, some years goes by and there might only be a handful of people signed up, and then some years people, like, no, last year nobody finished. Now, there was a guy last year who I know, who I raced a couple of years ago in the Yukon. So I did this other ultra marathon called the Yukon Arctic Ultra. It was 300-mile one. I did that and I came second in that. The guy that beat me, this guy called Jan, he's a Slovakian dude, he lives in America. Been living there for years. He's actually a doctor, and he was in Alaska this year trying to do that race while I was out. I actually just got off the Atlantic, and he got 600 miles in, but he ended up getting in a bit of trouble. He got like kind of frostbite and frostnip on his feet, and he pulled out anyway. Nobody made it to the finish line that year, so he's going back this year, and we're talking about sort of working together. We don't know how we're going to do it or if we're kind of 100% on it yet, but you know, we're gonna you know, start off together anyway, I'd say, and sort of see what happens, you know. But so I might be in a bit of a dynamic there, I don't know. But I mean, I'm not like, we're not you know, sort of chained to each other at this point. You know, a lot can happen between now and then. You know, he's still making sure he actually had the end of his finger amputated. So he's like not sure even if how that's gonna hold up in the cold, you know. So yeah, like it's you know, but so that it will be a lot different. We'll be going through villages and stuff, but it's you know, it's
another level.
Like, yeah, you're still gonna be completely on your own for a large sections of it. And it's gonna
for days at a time.
For days at a time, yeah. So it's gonna be you know, but I'll be drawn on a lot of the experiences of the past, you know, the other races and the Atlantic for sure, to sort of, you know, get me through it. You know, and hopefully make it to the finish line. A lot of it's weather dependent, you know, it's same as the Atlantic. You just don't know what sort of winter they're going to have up there this year. It could be like, you know,
yeah,
you know, a lot of snow. If there's a lot of snow, it's going to make it a lot tougher to travel. That's why working together with somebody else would be a good idea, because you could break trail, you know, take turns breaking trail in the snow, because you'd be wearing snowshoes, you'd be kind of stomping along.
Exactly.
You're pulling your sledge, you know, so you could help each other out. Like, it's, I think you increase your chances for sure of trying of finishing the race by working with somebody else. But then there's just that dynamic as well, which is, you know, it's there's a lot there. Like, you know, there's a lot to work to get around there. You know, you can drive each other fucking crazy.
Exactly. Like, you know, both of us, delicate balance.
Yeah, both of us have strong personalities, and like we don't know each other that well. You know, that's the reality. No. So, you know, and like when you get into a situation where you're, you know, kind of at your wit's end, and you know, a week in, and you're, you know, pretty cold and and sleep deprived. You know, your patience can be tested pretty easily. So,
but like that actually, that's another like interesting one on the ability to try and utilize those experiences to actually build it appropriately, or to build towards something larger like that. I've always found it interesting that there's, like, you can kind of work off certain principles. If you're in a team environment, it can be, there's a different type of mentality needed, but also if it's an individual, an individual motivation needed, on a very regular basis, like an extremely regular basis, something like that kind of race. Is there any particular elements that you find, or is there any particular pieces of self-talk that you have built up to a really, really high level now that help you an awful lot? Are your go-tos? Like, I always look at it from a very general person's kind of point of view. So a lot of people would be looking at you and going, oh my God, he's this amazing guy, he's doing this and this and it's fantastic stuff and he's just a superhero, and I'm like, that's fine, he is a superhero, but like at the same stage he has actually had to grow into that superhero. Do you have a particular pieces of be it thoughts or mantras that you use or you go back to?
Yeah.
Is there any pieces that you...
I've got a ton of stuff.
That was a good one.
I've got I'm not massive on like quotes because I just don't read that much. I don't read as much as you. I do listen to podcasts and stuff, and I try not to, you know, get too kind of crowded in that sort of space. But yeah, like I do, like I use a lot of, I suppose, techniques. Like people talk about sort of mental toughness, like mental resilience. It's a huge kind of buzzword nowadays, and I still actually don't know what it means. You know, but I really do know what mental trickery is. Like, and that's kind of what I'm an expert in. You know what I mean? And it's literally, that's what it is. Like, that's how you do it. You just fooling yourself into believing that it isn't that bad, essentially. And you need to just get on with it. So, you know, like I have so one of the things that I use, I think I did hear it in a podcast. I don't know where the guy got it from. He was like a sports psychologist, and he said this thing, stop listening to yourself and start talking to yourself. And that really stuck with me. I actually had to write it on the mirror in my bathroom last year. So, you know, this whole idea behind that is like, you know, just, the listening to yourself is something that, you know, everybody does, and it's what you're listening to. You're listening to, you know, doubt, anxiety, fear, you know, that sort of negative self-talk that goes on in everybody. And I recognize that. Like, I recognize that I don't care who you are, I don't care what you've achieved, like, you know, how successful you are in your life. Like, everybody has that going on, and it's the degree to which you listen to that voice, listen to that sort of stuff, you know. So it's like, you know, oh, I'm going to row the Atlantic, and then it's like, oh, well, how much is that going to cost? And like, you know, oh, like, what, you're going to have to leave your job? Like, you can't do that. Like, you need that security. You know what I mean? There's all this like stuff. So I was kind of, you know, the middle of last year, I was kind of confronted with like kind of the height of all that stuff. Like, there was like, you know, the middle of the summer, you know, like when I look back, training was going really well. I was, you know, super strong, really fit. You know, like I was organizing the boat, I was getting out, you know, like I look back, things are good. But internally, I was kind of like, you know, all over the place, because I didn't get these huge sponsors and stuff like that. I was kind of like, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was going to do about my job as a diver. I hadn't been diving in like nearly a year. I was like, shit, am I going to be able to go back to that? Exactly, you know, I was like kind of freaking out about that. Like, what's going to happen after this role? Like, I've basically put all my life savings into this, you know? And like, I just sort of said, you know what? No, like I need to stay true to that sort of spark of that sort of idea, that sort of passion, which was like, you know, when I read that book, like I read this book called Salt, Sweat and Tears by this guy called Adam Rackley. And he spoke about, you know, when he was out rowing in the middle of the Atlantic, and there was like the Milky Way in all its glory and the phosphorus and plankton. And I was like, that's why I'm doing it. I want to get out there and see what it's like out there. And that's been kind of like my drive all along. It's like I wanted to be a diver because I was like, oh man, I want to go down there and see what it's like when it's down there. And I was like, I've been down to like 200 meters in the Caspian Sea. I've seen whale sharks, fucking turtles, bloody manta rays, you name it. Like, I've seen it. Like, and then I've seen nothing as well because I've been buried in mud. You know what I mean? But I've been all these places. I've been to Antarctica, like, and it's always been that driving experience, like, that I've, like, I want to go there and do it and experience it. And that's, like, you know, that's the only kind of, you know, truth that I know in life, is that, like, go and try and experience something. But, like, there's always this kind of idea, this stuff going on inside that's like, well, no, don't do it, like, because you need to, like, be afraid, you know, you need to, you know, conform to this idea, this narrative of society, and, like, sort of, like, put away all your money and then do this all, do something when you're retired at 60, when you can't row across an ocean, you know. So I use so much of kind of like this mental kind of, I suppose, trickery, mindset, hacks, whatever you want to call it, to sort of get me through things, you know. And like, you know, going back to that sort of team thing and all that, like, you know, I actually probably would make a really good team member because I worked as a diver in a team environment for a lot of years, you know. But I suppose for me, what that taught me over the years is it taught me about sort of being like less emotionally reactive, you know. And that's been a huge part of how I got across the Atlantic. You know, obviously we just spoke about like kind of like a mindset hack and stuff like that. But really it comes down to sort of managing your emotions and being emotionally aware, you know. And this is where I kind of got this from diving, because like commercial diving is a super dangerous job. Like, you know, it's one of the most heavily regulated safety industries in the world. You know, everything we do is kind of built on the bones of, literally on the bones of other people that have died. Like, it's like, oh, well, why do we do that particular safety thing? So, well, because, you know, a bunch of guys died in the 80s. Someone, exactly, you know, everything, yeah, every, like, you know, yeah. And then if something, you know, if there's some sort of, you know, incident, there's another safety measure put in place, you know. It's just sort of like huge risk mitigation sort of environment. But part of that is like kind of being professional, and the guys that I work with are all these kind of ex-forces guys, you know. So they're all kind of pretty, you know, straight down the line, no bullshit sort of guys. But at the same time, you know, they're not very, like, they're used to being in situations where, you know, the shit's hitting the fan, and they're not sort of like going, oh, fucking hell, man, exactly, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people always say to me, like, oh, why isn't there a TV show, you know, Gold Divers, yeah, or something like that, you know? And
like, those guys are on a lake.
Yeah.
It's a different game.
Well, like, or Deadliest Catch, you know what I mean? Like, there probably should be a pretty cool TV show about diving, but the reality of it is it would probably be quite boring because...
It's so process-oriented.
Exactly, and, like, there could be something going down and you wouldn't notice about it, because in those TV shows, they're basically cowboys, and they're all flying off the handle every 5 minutes. That makes great TV. You know what I mean? They're exactly, like fucking kicking the shit out of each other, and like they're falling over and breaking legs, and you know, like we don't, like, we have incidences. Don't get me wrong. Like, we've had, you know, some serious shit happen, but like, you know, people aren't having like emotional reactions. They're not fucking flipping out. They're trying to like do the next thing that needs to do to, you know, to sort of mitigate the risk or you know, sort of make it a bit safer, whatever that is. So, diving taught me about sort of like staying on top of my emotions, you know, and not sort of having an emotional reaction, you know what I mean? And like losing the handle. So if you fly off the handle, like, you're kind of like, people are like, you know what I mean? Is that guy for real? Like, is in, that's basically, it's been unprofessional, you know what
Completely.
I mean? So that's kind of what I take into, you know, the stuff that I do. It's like, I just got to really be kind of aware of my emotions. And like, when I was out in the Atlantic, you know, bloody sleep deprived, like rowing 16 hours a day, like, you know, I had the tendency to be pretty, you know, pretty on the edge emotionally, you know what I mean? Like, there's a couple of times where I was like, you know, laughing hysterically, and then like 5 minutes later crying, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, full on batshit crazy. Yeah. But like, at the same time, I was very much aware of like my emotional state.
That you're listening to these emotions.
Yeah, and not sort of being ruled by them. Like, they're just sort of, you know, they're just emotions. They're not good or bad. I don't label them good or bad. I don't think to myself, oh, I'm having a bad day, so I need to try and get on top of my mental game here and make everything right. I think that takes more energy than just accepting where you're at.
Absolutely.
You can't be, like, that's why, you know, the whole, you know, fucking online fucking persona fitness industry is just the biggest load of bollocks science, because people are like always like, oh, we gotta like change our mindsets, and we gotta like be positive, and you know, we gotta get rid of this negativity. It's like, no, man, just be fucking negative. Like, you're allowed to do that. You can have a fucking day where you're like, fuck this. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I was like this morning. Like, I've had this injury.
You were out for a walk, though. You went out for a bit of a trek.
Yeah, I did four hours, you know? But it wasn't...
So most people do, like, a couple of bits and pieces. We do 20-minute walk, but Kevin does 4 hours.
Well, that was, it's not... it's 4 hours. I need to be doing that sort of my, you know, or more than that. But anyways, look, I did it anyway. But, you know, I wasn't in the greatest of headspaces, and I just left it at that. Like, I didn't attach too much to it. You know, I don't force things too much within myself. You know, if I'm having a good day, I'm having a good day. If I'm having a bad day, I'm having a bad day. And that's kind of the way it was in the Atlantic. Like, it really came back to, like, just accepting kind of where it's at. But just, you know, and then when you are accepting of that, when you have awareness of that, you just tend to be a little bit more even-keeled, you know? Mm-hmm. You're not as, like, you know, because what a lot of people, it happens to them is when they're not aware of their emotions, that's when they fly off the handle, or they say something they don't mean, you know what I mean, they react to somebody that says something, you know, and that's kind of like where I really try and sort of, like, you know, I'm kind of trying to be aware of myself and, you know, just not burning up energy foolishly, you know.
I like, while you were talking there, I was taking a couple of notes, because like, one of the first things anyways brought me back to a book that I have over there that I really, I think I may have been in the room actually, but it's called Black Box Thinking, and essentially it is talking about, I don't know if you, do you know about that?
No. Oh,
it's essentially what you were talking about there. We'll kind of reorganize it a little bit. Basically, it is essentially talking, it's based on the utilization of a black box in an airplane.
Right.
So the reasoning for a black box is so that you can ascertain what the situation was or certain details of a crash or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then ideally, rather than, like, just leave it and go, right, this happened, you actually utilize those details to fix the situation or to improve upon the situation.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing there is, if you, like the quote you said, if you are aware of these situations, or you're at least listening to the emotions or listening to your own self-talk, you can then kind of go, okay, well, can I filter correctly through what sounds really hyperbolic and what sounds quite reasonable?
Yeah.
I'm gonna probably use the fucking reasonable.
Yeah.
And, like, get rid of the hyperbolic. It depends on your situation.
Yeah.
Like, if we're sitting down here having a cup of tea, it's not gonna be a deal breaker if I have these mad crazy thoughts.
Yeah.
And I decide to pull a couple of things out. But if I decide I'm in the middle of the fucking Atlantic and I'm heavily sleep deprived, and then I start listening to the hyperbolic BS and I start pulling that out, then you have emotional reactions like that. But for me, the biggest thing to look towards is, and especially when it comes to adventuring or even in the kind of fitness world, it brought me back to a simple mentality of compounding interest in a couple of different ways. So for me, the way you were speaking just a little while ago was as in, I can double my money or I can actually lose a lot of money. So I can, if I do one thing, so I'll do a squat tomorrow.
All right.
Super simple. If I do two squats the following day, and then I do four squats the following day, I do eight squats the following day, and so on. Things start really, really spiraling out. But if I just decide to do one, 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 two, 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 fine. Which is the more important one? And it's likely that either one is going to work, but it's going to be very much dependent on how comfortable you are with your own self-talk and how comfortable you are with your own listening ability. And for me, though, it comes back to the thing you were speaking about diving. And like that, if you have to have built up that type of a compounding effect to stay organized under that level of pressure. Because otherwise you're not doing that. Like, you won't last long in that.
Yeah.
And like that, exactly, you said, it's quite a boring thing because everything has to be very process oriented. It has to be very straightforward. And that's what I was talking about, black box thinking. It should be a case of like a surgeon or something that happens, one of the biggest things there is, if you're a firefighter, do you really want loads of shit to go down? Not really, like, you want a quiet day, drink cups of tea, ideally, you kind of do in a way, you want loads of cool shit to go on, but if you have a quiet day and there's nothing going on, are you kind of okay with that? I'd say most firefighters are feckin' okay with that, you know?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people like to build fires and like to, you know, do you know what, my life isn't, it doesn't sound crazy enough, I'll pull a couple of the BS bits and pieces out of my own head.
Drama.
And just build a bit of drama for myself, which then makes it worse and more difficult to build that resilience of positive reinforcement. I think the best way of fixing it is the way you've been doing it, is by dodging it a lot, or at least changing tact.
Yeah.
Which has kept things really fresh, and at least it's forced you to learn new, maybe mental languages at least. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but that just resonated with me.
Yeah. No, it does totally. Like, I mean that, yeah. I mean, I always, like I said, sort of, you know, change tack and stuff. And, you know, but I think that, you know, going back to sort of that process driven idea, like, I mean, it's, I think I just, you know, when I think about some of the things that I do, it's super repetitive, you know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's all kind of like one, you know, taking steps, yeah. 1-2, 1-2. Mm. I think that I'd be pretty good at like the wax on, wax off thing, you know, but when it comes to actual skill level, like I wouldn't really be very good at karate, like, yeah. You know.
But I think it depends, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so like, yeah, so I suppose, yeah, like one of the things that was big for me, I'll just share this kind of story about the Atlantic, was the baby wipes that I had on board. So I I had 750 baby wipes, and this is a cool little story because you know, it really gives you an idea of like the process driven mentality that I would have had. And it was that you know, I before I went out there, I spoke to a few ocean rowers, and I said, like, what's the most important tip you can give me about rowing across an ocean? They said, like, you gotta look after your contact points. And I was like, all right. So they said, you know, your hands, you gotta look after your hands, you gotta look after your bum, like, you know. So obviously you're wearing gloves and you're changing your kind of grip and stuff like that, but your arse is a different story. You've got to, like, you know, you're on the seat for 16 hours a day, you know, it's sweaty, it's salty, you know, there's waves coming over the back deck, you know, it can get messy back there. And I saw some photos of these salt sores on people's arses, you know. So I was like, right, I can't be getting those, they look horrendous, you know. So I wanted to try and enjoy myself out there, and I heard these stories about people, like, you know, sitting down after a couple hours off, and it's just been excruciating, you know. So what I ended up doing is I took these baby wipes, took 750 baby wipes at me, and the idea was that I was going to, you know, keep the hygiene back there, you know what I mean. So basically I'd get baby wipes, my shift pattern was like 3 hours on, 1 hour off. I started at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I did that kind of all day long, you know, varied a bit. And then at nighttime, I'd sleep a block of like 3 hours, you know? So what I do after each shift of 3 hours, I go back in the cabin. I'd have to, like, you know, get the jet boil out, make my food, rehydrate my meal, you know, do my navigation, make sure, you know, the solar panels are clean, like talk to my weather guy. Like, there's a bunch of stuff like admin that I had to do on the boat. It wasn't just all about rowing. But the one thing that I, you know, was that I had to do after getting in was like to basically get the baby wipes out, you know. And I used to get one baby wipe out and clean one cheek, and one baby wipe out and clean the other cheek. And then I had this like family sized thing of Sudocreme, you know, the massive one that would last you like 20 years. So I had that, exactly, and I'd like lather up my arse with that, you know, and then I'd be okay to do what I had to do, you know. So yeah, like I went through pretty much all my baby wipes the whole way across, you know. And like, despite being, you know, like coming in and literally just like flaking out on the spot, you know, like halfway through a meal, like, you know, covered in like food dripping down and stuff like that, you know, I still managed to do that little kind of discipline, you know. And it was just that little thing. And I always put it, you know, put that down to like being just a really, really important little thing, you know. And like, I don't know if you've seen those Matt Fraser videos, the latest ones, you know.
Oh yeah, what
you do when nobody's looking.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that's essentially,
it's huge.
That, and that's what I talk about, and it's the exact same thing. I talk about like that idea of like, you know, the sort of micro the small things, the building blocks to your success, you know, the stuff that not necessarily people see what you're doing.
It's the cement.
Yeah, and that's what that was. That was those baby wipes, those 750 baby wipes that I went through every day was like, you know, the building block to my success that got me across the Atlantic. Like, I finished third out of 12 boats. I beat like all the three mans, all the other pairs, the other solos, you know. I like had this ridiculous race. I was one of the fastest boats to ever cross the Atlantic solo, you know. And it all came down to like, you know, the basics, and that was one of the basics, you know. And I always say it in like some of the talks that I do, like, you know, I achieved a huge amount, like, but like the thing I'm most proud of is the fact that I didn't get a salt sore on my arse. You know what I mean? Because
exactly,
of that little thing,
yeah,
you know. You know, so like that, I suppose, like when I look at things, like I really identify, you know, the small detail things, and I just say like, okay, that's important and I need to do that. And like I've got those identified
for the Iditarod.
You know, for the Iditarod, like I know those things already, like, you know, I mean, it's essentially the same thing, you know. I'm gonna get like this crazy chafing my gooch. You know, and I have this, I have this spray that I put on my feet. That I'm doing it. I haven't started doing it yet, but I'll do it a few weeks beforehand. Spray your feet like every twice a day. And it hardens up the skin to stop you getting blisters, you know. And like, you know, just that sort of discipline of, you know, just like you said, the compounding effect, you know, of effect of stuff. And that's like, you know, when you're in a situation where you know, on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic, and something isn't right, you know, if something needs to be fixed, like, you need to fix it right there, because it's going to compound into this sort of like mess, basically, because it's just a harsh environment where things don't you know, things break very easily. If you think, oh, I'll deal with that later, you know, you go back later and it's gotten 10 times worse, you know. And it's the same thing with the Iditarod, the same thing with, you know, anything that I do. And it's definitely hard. It's a really hard thing to do because, you know, you're in the heat of the moment. You're thinking to yourself, like, especially in a race situation, you know, if you're like, if I'm in the Iditarod and I'm in a race and I can feel a hot spot in my foot, like, I've got a blister coming. It's like, oh no, I'll deal with that, like, in 5 kilometers time. I'll deal with that when I get.
Because you can handle it fairly well within reason, like, you may at the time, but
no, but it's gonna compound. So like that blister will get bigger. Like, so what I'm trying to say is, like, I always try and, like, if there's a situation where I need to, something needs to be dealt with, like, I need to say, well, I need to stop and deal with it because it's just going to get worse. And that all comes back to decision making. So essentially, everything boils down to decision making. Like, that's kind of like, people don't really think about it. They think about what the fuck is decision making? Like, oh, do I go left or do I go right?
Yeah.
A lot of it's intuitive, you know what I mean? You don't have to think about things. But like, if I said to myself before I got in the Atlantic, I said to myself, I worked with this company called Peak Dynamics, and they work with, like, kind of adventurers. They work with, you know, people in business and stuff, just to sort of, you know, kind of make their mental game better, like, make them more efficient and stuff. And this guy, Sandy, who I work with, he's done these kind of personality tests on me, and I've kind of been identified as, like, this kind of, obviously, alpha, kind of, like, you know, a bit of a knucklehead, like, you know, kind of kind of white line fever, you know, like, like, very much so, like, you know, what they call summit fever. If I would be kind of type of guy, would be like, you know, I want to get to the summit of that mountain, but look, no, there's a massive weather system coming in. No, we're getting to the summit. And I had to change that mentality, you know, to sort of, like, be a decision maker, and like, just to be like, okay, I'm going to be a decision maker. And people don't, like, well, what the fuck does that mean? And it's like, well, you know, it's like, okay, hang on a sec, these are important decisions I have to make every day, like, and I have to be like, okay, I need to make good decisions. Like, so be it that, like, okay, do I need to, you know, have a hydration tablet right now? Do I need to, you know what I mean, take extra food on board? Do I need to get extra sleep this one particular night? Like, these are all, like, super important decisions, like, that you probably wouldn't really think too much about.
Yeah.
But, like, compounded.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to, like, either be, you know what I mean, the fact that you're, you know, you know, you've made it to the end or not, you know? Yeah. So, like, that's a huge part of, like, what I do when I go out there. It's like, you know, I'm super aware that, like, okay, what decision do I have to make next?
Yeah.
And, like, let's talk about this. And, like, I have the communication with myself. It's like, okay, well, like, okay, hang on a sec. Is that a hot spot on my foot? Okay, hang on a sec. Okay, it is. I need to stop now. Yeah. I need to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, right, I need to, you know what I mean? So there's always that dialogue, you know, of decision making. It's like, right, well, what's the next right move? What's the next right decision? Like, you know, because the last thing Sandy had said to me before I went out there, he just said, just make good decisions.
Yeah.
That was it. Like, that's essential. Like, I mean, it's like, fucking blatantly obvious.
It's so huge.
It's so huge. It's like, yeah, like, just really make huge good decisions. Like, that, and just be like, okay, these are like, and, you know, instead of being like, you know, again, it all comes back to that emotional thing. Like, okay, well, you know, kind of, you know, oh, like, something's broken, or and then you try and fix it, and then you break it some more. It's like, no, exactly, you need to take, like, a step back, or whatever it is, like, you know, just to, like, be aware. And it, like, just gives you a little bit more sort of room to sort of, like, be, you know, aware of the scenario that you're in, or whatever that decision is, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
I think exactly like that. A big point of that is the ability to be a strategist rather than being really romantic about certain things. Like the way you talked about summit fever there.
Yeah.
Like, some people are okay with being, like, really romantic, and they're just like, I'm going for it, fuck it.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if you were to be successful in a lot of these endeavors, or even the most banal endeavors, you need to be your own best strategist.
Yeah.
Like, you have to tell yourself, this is the plan, stick to the fucking plan.
Yeah.
Or at least you have to make sure that you're going through the mentality of building the actual plan correctly, like, or having patience with yourself about it.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, on, like, and this is a big one. Most people don't, and most people will not ever experience some of the activities you've done, or some of the experiences you've gone through, be it in your past or in your most recent past.
Yeah.
So they haven't built up, they haven't built up the need for that kind of strategy orientation. Yeah. So if Joe Soap, dog in the street or whatever it is, decides now, like, right, I want to get my shit together, I want to get my act together, I want to start, like, I might do a bit of the old ocean rowing for the crack, and
yeah,
I'll do a bit of this here and there. I think one of the best things they can do, and it reminds me a lot there, is just start becoming really good at chess with yourself.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to start thinking about exactly what is the vital stuff, what's the non-vital stuff. Like, posting on Instagram about this, blah, 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 is maybe not the most interesting thing, the most cool thing in the world, or the most important thing you can do in the fucking world.
Yeah.
But at the same stage, if this is part of a chain of compounding effect that you need to build a certain thing, then it might be quite a big thing. You know what I mean? It could be something simple like that, but
yeah.
I think I just find that interesting, the way you talk about that.
Yeah, that's funny, because I do these kind of corporate talks, so I go in and I talk to corporates and schools and all a range of different things, and I kind of speak about, like, you know, well, I can go in there and I could be all like, oh, look, you know, I've rowed across an ocean.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been out there. You don't know what it's fucking like. Exactly. And you don't. Like,
you don't.
You're like, there's been like...
No, I'd like... Yeah, and know, like, and
that,
I, do
I don't. I don't approach it that way. I don't approach it in terms of like, oh, like...
Just forcing it on people. No.
No, I don't. And I don't think of it in terms of... like, because the reality is, no. Like, there's only been two guys from this country who've rowed across an ocean solo. So, like, you know, you can't actually identify
somebody
that.
Somebody has to be those guys.
But no, at the same time, like, what I try and, you know, instill in people is that, like, you know, what it took for me to get to that place, which was, like, getting through those barriers of doubt and fear and anxiety. Like, the same stuff that I was talking about earlier, the same stuff that everybody's going through on a daily basis. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, that is the unique human experience. Like, that is where we are exactly the same. You know what I mean? The only difference is, like, is the output, the stuff that I did. Like, the input is the same, like, the stuff that's in, you know. So, like, I think that, you know, I try and identify people. I don't try and, like, be like, oh, like, I'm so different and I'm so unique and all that. Like, I look for similarities, you know, and I see it every day. Like, I see it in every person I talk to, you know, and every, you know, the... Most people that you meet are sort of ruled by fear, really. They're just in a you know. Absolutely. So and like, that's kind of one of the kind of whole things with my talks and the stuff that I'm trying to do. Like, I did a thing last night for a bunch of kind of young offenders who were did an adventure program. It was amazing, through Faroga, you know, and it was so class. They were like 16, 17 year olds who'd been in a bit of trouble, you know, and then they did this course and they, you know, sort of got to experience, like, you know, surfing, kayak and all sorts of stuff for a few months. And, you know, it was, you know, super positive to see that, you know, but the reality is, like, you know, they're kind of at that point now where, you know, they mightn't go back to, they could just go back to their old lives and stuff like that, you know. But I told them my story and I shared them a few photos, and, you know, one of the young lads came up to me afterwards and he said, like, how did you do that? And I just said, look, man, just, like, don't worry about things. Just try and start to, you know, go towards the things that you want to do, and it'll, you know, just have some sort of belief. And I think that it all comes back to that. You know, I look back at the way I was when I was 19 or even that kid's age, I just had zero belief, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a case of, like, you know, going out into the world and doing a couple of different things, starting surfing, you know, traveling to Australia, learning to be a diver, you know, living in Bali for a while, like, going snowboarding. It was just like, you know, one thing after another.
Yeah.
And then eventually it's like, hang on a minute, you know, you could row across the Atlantic if you wanted that. And, like, it's taken 15 years for that to come about, like, you know, that belief.
The overnight,
you know,
success.
You know, exactly. And exactly. It's like, you know, and then I just look at, like, these young lads and I know how they feel, like, because I know, I was there myself, like, they, you know.
It's not easy, though.
Yeah, it's not. But then I think, fucking hell, so where are we going wrong as a society? Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, so I suppose it's just trying to instill belief in people, really.
Yeah.
You know, just to break away from, like, that thought process of coming back to what I said, like, fear. Mm-hmm. You know, just pushing the boat out, no pun intended. Yeah. You know what I mean? And, like, it doesn't have to be, you know, everyone has an ocean to cross in their lives. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical one, you know.
Exactly,
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not into, you know, comparing stuff, like, because, you know, you know, there's always going to be, like, I can always find some other lunatic who's done 10 times much stuff than me, you know, or I can feel totally insecure. Like, it's not about that. Like, it's about doing whatever the fuck you want to do, like, be it, like, you know,
Crow Patrick.
What was I trying to say? I was trying to say crochet.
Crochet, yeah. Well, no, that's exactly.
Crochet, if you want to do crochet. Yeah, you know.
But absolutely.
And that all comes back to what I was saying earlier about being defined by something, you know. It doesn't fucking matter. Like, it can be anything. Just go out and try something, you know. Yeah. I don't know. Like, yeah. I don't know if I'm making any fucking sense.
I think it's going fine. I think, like, well, we could leave it there, Gavin, if you like. If you got to go do that, we could.
No, let's keep going, man.
We can keep on trucking.
Let's talk about training. We
got a good bit of stuff, yeah. So we can get a little bit more into detail on that. So at the moment, what does your training look like? Like, you're doing fairly good volume. Like, for the ocean roll.
Oh, yeah. So for the ocean.
Even for, like, the Yukon stuff, you're doing some crazy training. But the logistics of that, the actual amount of, like, you're talking about an injury you currently may have kind of experiencing. Obviously, you're like the without any real kind of playing around the subject, like, you're hurting at times going through these kind of elements. Yeah. Or you're at least, most people are going, Jesus Christ, I can't do that. Oh my God, I'd be broken if I did an hour of that. Like, I walk down this, I do a half an hour of walk or jog, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm busted.
Yeah.
You're easily wandering in doing a 4 hour. Without any major deal breakers, like, you're like, yeah, it's a moderate one. But I think a lot of the time it comes back to, is it just being aware of, like, okay, I'm okay today with this amount.
Yeah.
It's just that self-knowledge to kind of go, okay, well, I don't always need to be 110% crazy. Like,
yeah.
I need to find a cadence that will work for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots there with the training stuff. Like, just currently, to give you perspective, like, I do have this, like, I think it was Emma's my physio, I'm pretty sure it's like a little tear, you know?
Yeah. So in your quads.
Yeah, sort of just
to up, tape flexor.
Yeah, sort of into the up near the hip flexor, not quite the hip flexor, just top of the quad. So yeah, that was unfortunate, but like, that was volume based. I was doing a bit much there the last while. I did a couple of adventure races there at a mountain race up in the Moorings. That was good. And then I went to America for a few weeks. I was meant to do a 50 miler, and it was just true training for out there. And I got a bit excited. There's lots of amazing trails out there. Yeah. I was running pretty hard. The difference with the trails over there, and that there's, well, the lack of trails here, is that when you're coming, I do like quite a lot of, you know, hill walking, mountain running, whatever you want to call it, more walking up, running down. But you can't run down as well here, because it's too treacherous. There's no actual trail. It's so slippy. Yeah. Over there, they've got these single track. You can kind of fly down, and whatever happens, I was just pounding down these hills, and I just ended
just
up.
Just pushed it a bit harder.
Yeah, I just pushed it. And so, obviously a little bit gutted that happened, you know, but training wise, like, it's been a tough one, because, like, you know, people said to me, like, you know, before the Atlantic, like, how much training have you done? And I was like, the most I did was, like, I think I was in the boat for nearly 48 hours, like 44 hours or something like that. And that was, like, the longest, like, and that was out proper ocean rowing where I went up the coast from Dingle. That was the most I'd done, you know. So the whole time I was like, you know, you're thinking to yourself, like, how am I actually going to row 5,000 kilometers? Yeah, exactly, because, like, you know, you're just coming, everybody comes from this linear thinking, like, okay, so I'm going to do a marathon. So I'm going to run, you know, 5 miles, then I'll run 10 miles, then I'll run 22 miles, and you might run, you know, close enough to a full one. Like, there's no point where I'm going to be like, okay, I'll do like 4,000, you know what I mean? 1,000 kilometers, then I'll
completely,
be, then I'll do half, you know. So you're in this complete unknown. And it's also the same with, you know, the sort of the walking, like, 4 hours isn't a hell of a lot. But I'm going to be doing you know, probably more like 14 or 16 or 18 a day, you know. But you know, I sort of, my kind of mentality around all that is, again, it all comes back to the adaption. It's just kind of getting the right sort of stimulus, and I get that stimulus through, like, strength training and CrossFit. And I suppose, you know, it was through CrossFit really that the whole idea of that, you know, like, CrossFit endurance, like, it's like, it gets away from that whole, like, volume based approach. Like, I grew up as a competitive swimmer, and it was just like
the minimum,
you know,
dose for maximum
well, it was just
kind of
volume
thing.
You know what I mean? Like, you just did, you know what I mean, it was all about how much you did a week. Like, and like, it just was, there's no sense to it, you know. And like, so I think volume has a place in any plan, don't get me wrong, but I just think, like, there's a lot of other ways to skin a cat, like, and the way that I did, that I kind of did that, was through a lot of strength training. Like, I was, you know, doing a 5 and 5 most of last year, while I was kind of doing 10 and 10 towards the end of the year. I was doing a lot of, you know, 10, 10 DVTs, squats.
But yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of really working on the idea of like being kind of physically strong, you know what I mean? So to be sort of withstanding injury, you know what I mean? Which I didn't. I actually did my back in, but that was more biomechanical.
And you've been a knucklehead.
Yeah.
But this is the hard part of it, that the, even talking about the earlier plans and stuff, like, for me, a big thing with all of those events, they will all have, like, they may sound endurancy, but they're all distinctly different beasts individually. Like,
yeah,
the Iditarod Trail is going to be very different than Baikal, like Lake Baikal, or very different than your ocean row. So there's only so much preparation you can do before you have to actually adapt within the...
Not necessarily. Like, at the end of the day, like, it all comes back to a low heart rate.
Yes.
So... like I do, you know, this film Aftone, you know, Zone. So I've dabbled in that. Like
it is excellent.
I don't adhere to it like 100%. Like,
no.
You know, like I am it by default.
Yeah.
Because like I trained last year, you know, obviously I had a row machine. Like everybody knows how horrible a row machine is. I literally to this day, like an all-out 2K row is one of the scariest physical
it's
things
terrible.
That I, like in that and Fran scare me the most and Kalsu, like, you know.
Yeah,
So like, you know, I always had this fear of the row machine and I had it a lot last year because I had this row machine in my living room, but I worked off heart rate. I had the Concept 2 with the heart rate monitor.
Yeah.
And so I was able to see my heart rate and I didn't let my heart rate go above, 140, whatever it is, 180 minus rage. So 140, 145. So I just kept that low heart rate zone and just worked in that. And then that sort of, that was essentially what the row was like. I didn't, because you think about it, you're rowing like 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
If you're trying to be, you know, like
a hero,
beast,
like, yeah.
You know,
you're just gonna get,
you know, so then you're getting into this whole other area of like, you know, your diet then with the whole fat burning and like that whole realm of stuff. And that was all really interesting for me. And like, you know, that's another huge kind of discussion and maybe we can have right now, obviously, but that whole thing, like I lost 13 kilos, you know, out there. And you know, this whole idea that you have to put on like a ton of weight beforehand, which is what I did. I walk around at like 77 kilos. I'm, you know, 5'9".
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like a sort of low body weight sort of guy anyway. I was never able to put on like massive amount of weight. Last year I did all this strength training, you know, on top of like, you know, this MAF zone sort of stuff where I was like rowing like 2-3 hours in the morning, you know, sort of, I was still doing other things as well. I was still, I did a half Ironman last year, you know, a 50 miler run, you know, I was doing all other stuff. And then I was trying to put on weight as well. So I was eating like a horse, you know, just eating kind of, you know, trying to be healthy, but eating high fat, just, you know, getting it into me. And I got up to 85 kilos. So I was just over 85 kilos when I set off across the Atlantic. And I lost 13 kilos. So I got off the boat 14 days. I was 73 kilos, which isn't, I don't know, like I right now I'm 77. I walk around 77 comfortably.
Yeah.
You know, I could probably I could easily be a couple more. I could easily be a little bit under that. So 73 isn't that much
not
off,
a deal breaker,
you know, like, and when I saw photos of myself, I wasn't like freaked out, you know, and I definitely wasn't getting the, you know, the calories into me. Now, what I saw happen there was that, like, what ended up happening, like, I saw within myself is that the first kind of 10 days, we had, like, pretty hectic weather out there. So it was, like, really lumpy. Like, we had, like, big waves, like, and it was good. Like, I made great ground because it was all following seas. But what ended up happening is I just couldn't get the food into me. Like, I had these freeze-dried meals, like, a lot of, like, curries and stuff like that. Like, kind of acid. It felt like I was eating acid. Like, these chili con carne meals that were just horrendous. Like, I was like, ugh. So I ended up eating like a lot of like lower calorie kind of wet meals because we had these wet meals on board. So basically you have to bring a large percentage of dry meals. So I had 80% dry meals and then 20% wet meals. The reason why that is because if your water maker breaks and your hand pump water maker breaks and then your ballast water, which is like 60 liters of drinking water, that somehow runs out and you can't hydrate anything, then you eat your wet meals. Like, it's like a major, you know, huge kind of contingency. But anyways, but those wet meals weigh a ton. Like, so basically, like, you know, like a kind of, you know, you get these like...
rice pudding or
beans and sausage.
Yes,
like, in a can, but like they're in a bag. So stuff like that, kind of army ration. So I was eating those, but they're low calorie. And I was getting feck all into me. I ended up losing a lot of the weight in the first like kind of 10 days. And then I kind of went into this state of maybe it was fat burning, I don't know, but like I was a slow burn for the rest of it. So I don't know. I didn't have a bloody weighing scales on board, so I don't know exactly what happened, but I think
where the switch came.
Almost that, like, it was kind of pointless for me to put on like that much weight and spend that much time trying to put on that much weight just for it to kind of go really quickly and then for like this slow burn to come off. So going into, I did a sport in Alaska. I'm probably going to be about this weight, which is controversial.
Yes.
controversial.
Exactly.
To like
it
other people in the realm that I'm in. So, and like, I'm a massive like fat guy. Like, I'm a huge fat burner. Like, I eat, like, I mean, people wonder like if they're a fat burner or not. Like, I know you can go get tested, but like, you just know, like, when you're, you know, if you do like a wad and you want to drink a can of Coke afterwards, you're not a fat burner. Like,
no,
you're exactly, you know what I mean? You're dipping into glycogen stores. Yeah. You're going to want to, like, you know, get that sort of stuff back into you.
Yeah.
Like, I specifically train, like, you know, kind of on empty stomachs at times. Like, I do workouts and I don't, like, you know, have that sugar hit afterwards, you know? You know, so I kind of, I don't know, I feel like I'm more adapted to burning fat.
Yeah.
You know, and I do crave like kind of fattier things, like, so, you know, I'm a huge fan of butter and cream and stuff with that and pork scratchings and nuts and things. Like, I'm mad for, like, when I was on the Atlantic, I had MCT oil that I'd pour into my meal. So I had fucking liters of this stuff and I'd pour a few teaspoons in, you know, and then I had these jars of peanut butter, you know,
just
proper.
Going down on them, like,
yeah, I went to town on them, but what ends up happening with peanut butter is, if you start eating it, you go through the oil pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So that it's kind of dry then. But I had the MCT oil. I was adding the MCT oil to the peanut butter, like making a pure sloppy. And then I was able
Amazing
to get it down
stuff.
Me. Like, yeah.
It's pretty serious goal.
Yeah. And then I had, what was it? Cans of sardines in olive oil.
Yeah.
And I was just, I had, you know, the little lemon thing, you know, that you put in the fridge.
Yeah.
I'd squirt a bit of lemon on that, put a little salt on it and just guzzle the whole thing. You know, so yeah, like I crave kind of fattier things. I love pork scratching. So that's kind of what I'll be doing in Alaska. This time around, I'll have the Dairy Gold sachets, you know, the little.
That's so good.
So I'll have those in my meals, so you know. So I still have a high amount of carbs, don't get me wrong, but I really push, and that, because it's more calories as well, don't get me wrong, it's a good
but
thing to do. Yeah,
but it, like that, it's going to be quite interesting. Like you're saying there, it's quite controversial for the other crew that are doing that, because like, you definitely remind me a lot of the Tim Ferriss type style person who's just like, you're quite aware of your current physiology, but also you're very willing to make a good decision and go, okay, well, look, this feels good, this is working quite well, we're probably going to roll with this, even if it's a bit controversial.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing either.
Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think the way you're speaking about the row, though, if you were to do that a second time, or you were to recommend it to somebody else, like Damien Brown, example, who's doing it too, he's going to have a different physiology. So he's going to have
a
different exactly. He's a tank-like. So
126 kilos, yeah.
That's the thing. So, but would you, if you were to do it again, would you... You obviously would you just have a different contingency plan food-wise in the middle, or would you just expect, or would you try and analyze a little bit more of the actual detail of the whole process that went through for the entire role, like the actual breakdown of it?
Yeah.
To find out a bit more.
Or
is that a sports scientist job?
I think
you're
that's
the
more...
Adventurer. You're the adventurer.
Like, I am kind of... Like, it's nice that you mentioned Tim Ferriss. Like, I do... I've listened to a lot of his stuff, and he's kind of, you know...
Experimentation
with himself. And I feel like I probably should go and get blood work done and stuff like that, and like he does, and sort of be a bit more...
probably pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I haven't done that. I haven't really bothered. Like, I suppose one of the... I think one of the requirements for the stuff that I do, like... You know, you have to be able to eat anything.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a fussy eater.
Oh yeah.
If you're a fussy eater, you're not gonna survive. Like, yeah. And I can see that straight away in people. Like, there was a guy who I did a race with a few years ago, and he was like, you know, he was real particular about his food, and I was just thinking, this isn't gonna work out for me.
You're not gonna win anyway.
He didn't finish it. Like, yeah. And like, what I mean by that is just that, like, yeah, you just. You don't get too fussy like about it. Think like, this is calories, I need to get into me, you know. So there's definitely an element of, like, you know, I suppose what we're talking about earlier, thought process driven with the food stuff. But at the same time, you know, I wasn't super strict with, you know, you know, the sort of fat burn, I don't know, Kijang, whatever you want to call it. I've never been any of those things, you know. Like I had these dried meals on board. I had like, you know, 90 days of these meals at home, mixed them. And then I had these 2000 calorie snack packs. So they were like these packs. And when I did a race a few years ago, this Leike's Arctic Ultra, it took like eight days. I brought these similar sort of things, like a snack pack. So I had 2000 calorie packs. And basically the idea was that I would have these packs on me like at all times, and I'd have one every few hours, and I had them all in the sled. So they were like a mixture of like biltong, like proper like South African biltong, you know, like fucking dark chocolate covered golden berries, bloody like cashews, like I had like a Kendall milk cake, which is like really I had like these you know, the sort of mix of like stuff, basically what I'm trying to say, like a full kind of spread of macros, you know, but like all good quality stuff. And these packs were all similar, and what ended up happening is that the mint cakes sort of like congealed inside these packs all over the biltong, the salt from the biltong. So I ended up with this like sticky lump of fucking shite. And like the first day I was like, oh, this isn't too bad. I was kind of like eating bits of chocolate and like bits of like biltong. And then by the second day I was like, fuck, I can't stomach this. Yeah. And I had like this sled full of like these packs that are absolutely identical. So it drove me fucking mental. And I was like cursing myself, you know, in the end. And then I ended up getting like a whole bunch of... you know, those chocolate fingers off somebody. And I just was like living on those for a couple of days.
Just simple.
You know what I mean? Like
something
really simple. Yeah. And like I just said, fucking hell, get off your highfalutin like shite. Just have a varied amount of stuff. Bring good quality things, but also bring shit that you're gonna want to eat when the times are tough. Like, and like I brought these 2000 calorie packs that I spent fucking ages packing at home in the living room. With all sorts of stuff. Like I had all types of bars in there. You know, like packs of olives, like just a real mix, real varied mix of stuff, which is really good. But I had these sour Skittles in the odd pack, you know. And about 4 days into the fucking row, I was like rooting through the hold, pulling out the sour Skittles, because I was just like, they were just the only thing I wanted to eat that particular time, you know. So I was like fucking chewing on these like sour Skittles, like pulling this face, and then of course all the acid's going into my stomach, it's making me feel even worse. You know, but I just
it is mad how when, like, I suppose like that, there's extreme events like that are gonna need extreme eating or extreme reactions from your body and from your mentality to what you actually crave. Like, I think that's where this is getting into a very different kind of realm, but at the same stage it's a good fun realm. The level of play the subconscious will have on some of those type of events is really interesting for me, because it's counterintuitive nearly. We'd say the sour Skittles, for example. You know in your heart and soul, you're like, right, this is going to give me a bit of a buzzkill in the stomach. But I'm having those fuckers, like. And you're like 4 days, 5 days into an ocean row, and you're like, you're obviously having an interesting conversation with yourself, but then also like your subconscious is having a significantly other different conversation as well. So I think that's an interesting one, that you just have to roll with what's on hand. Like, you can have all of these big ass plans, but you really have to have the ability to, like you're saying, adapt, though, and you have to roll with that adaptation.
Well, the thing with the row is that like I had 90 days of food on board, so I finished in 49 days, so I had a lot of food. I could afford to like kind of like, you know, dig through stuff, and I actually emptied food out in the last week. Yeah, I emptied out 90 meals over the side, because I was in this hectic race with this American boat, these three guys, and they were catching me. So I was like, marginal gains, baby.
No mercy at all.
Yeah, I was like, what can I do? So I started, I was like, I'm fucking gonna drop as much weight as I can. So like, aside from throwing vital things over the board that I needed to survive, I needed to keep, you know, I would have got disqualified from the race if I like threw my anchor overboard or whatever. You know, so look, I emptied out like a load of meals. So, plus, for one, I was there's no way I was gonna eat these fucking chili con carnes. I was sick to death of them. And two, like, I wanted to just get rid of the bulk, you know. So I emptied out all these meals, you know. But like, when it comes to so I could afford to be a bit more like, you know, play around with things, you know, which was nice, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, I had everything on the boat, and I suppose people, like, again, what people need to realize is that, like, the ocean row is like obviously a tough thing to do, but, you know, I was kind of always had this kind of mentality, like, that I'm only like 3 foot away from my bed at all times. You know what I mean? And I get it was loads of times where, you know, things were going horrendously wrong, like with the weather. Like, we'd have these really what would happen is that so the trade winds blow across the Atlantic, mm-hmm. and you generally you've got favorable winds following you. So you've got like, you know, this decent sort of 15-20 knot wind mm-hmm. breeze, and when you stop rowing, you're still getting a push. So you've got this yeah. autopilot that keeps you kind of on the heading, and you can sleep for an hour or two, mm-hmm. and you're gonna wake up and have gained miles. It's yeah. fucking amazing. You're mm-hmm. like awesome, you know. So then you keep going, you stack it all on top, you know. You, obviously, you go faster on your own, so you're trying to row as much as possible. But like, what happens sometimes is obviously the weather changes, and you get weather coming from the other direction, from north, from south, and there's quite a lot of situations or instances where you get these convective storms that would pick up. Mm. So basically, like especially the further west and south you got, and it would kind of, you'd see them building in the distance, and all of a sudden it would be this massive downpour, and the wind would pick up to like 40 knots, and you'd be just like, you know, you'd be getting shot like a slingshot.
Yeah.
It would be amazing. You know, you're flying. I was doing 5 knots at one stage, just scooting along. You know, it was epic. Mm. And then all of a sudden it goes over you,
yeah.
and it sort of kills the wind. So the trades are gone. And then what ends up happening is you get this convoluted sea. So you've kind of, you would have had normal sort of decent swell
yeah.
lines rolling from the trades. Then this kind of, this convective storm comes in. It kind of picks everything up. It gets a bit crazy. And then all of a sudden it stops. The wind drops. The wind dies. Then you're left with this kind of like, kind of,
awkward,
you know, bobbing
stuff.
Around
yeah.
sort of thing. And it's so, it was so frustrating because you're like, you're putting 1 hour in, and then you're like missing the catch, and you're like, 1 hour is up in the air, the other one's in the water.
That's a nightmare.
And you're kind of, and you're not getting
yeah.
anywhere, and you're doing like a knot, a knot and a half. And then if there's any sort of like adverse current, you
yeah.
know, that's, that affects you in some way. So, you know, it just, it became like
a
really, really, really battle mentally, like, you know, so, you know, that, but like I said, you know, I was always like a couple of feet from my bed. So
yeah.
I was like, I just think to myself,
you had certain attachment.
Let's just go into bed and lie down,
yeah.
you know what I mean? And have a meal or something, you
yeah.
know, and then come back and tackle it in an hour. It's still going to be there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe it'll change, you know?
Yeah.
The difference with, you know, the dinner sport and stuff with that is that like, I'll have to be thinking about like my calories a bit more because I'm pulling everything. I'm pulling it
exactly.
behind me,
yeah,
the sled.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I got to think about like, what's the most dense nutrient thing that I can get into me. And that's like a lot of fat stuff, you know?
What kind of weight are you going to have on the sled?
So I just got this sled. You probably saw my little Instagram
yeah,
story.
It looks cool.
Yeah, yeah. I got this carbon Kevlar sled from Norway. It's like a special expedition sled. Like, so I have this. I've had a plastic sled in the past, which are great. Like, don't get
yeah.
me wrong, they're still light and quite durable. I've actually got a big hole in the bottom from a chunk of ice in like Lake
yeah.
Baikal. But anyways,
yeah.
so yeah, I needed a new sled. I said, "Feck it, I'm gonna get this all bells and whistles thing." And these guys in Norway make these like insane like expedition sleds. They cost a lot of money. They're ridiculous. Like, so I rang the guy up. I said, "Look, I need this sled. You know, I knew a couple of guys who had them for the ultras. You know, they're a special small sled."
Mm-hmm.
The guy was like, "Yeah, yeah. So like, what's the payload?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. Like, he's, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, you need to know the exact payload. That's the exact strength
yeah, yeah.
that we're gonna make it. Like,
mm-hmm.
so it all depends on how much you're putting in it.
Wow.
You know." So, and he said, "Look, the way we try and make them is that like, you know, when you finish what you're doing, the sled should like fall apart."
Oh my god.
Like, we know that it's been successful. Like,
yeah.
if the sled like literally like deteriorates in the last like few days or something like that.
Oh,
like, my
word.
What?
Oh my
so
god.
Like, that's the whole idea. That it's so light and so like that
it's just
bare
minimum.
Bare minimum, yeah.
That's
so I just
savage.
Said to him, "Don't make it like that. I want to be able to use it again."
That's brilliant.
So I said, like, add a bit extra,
yeah.
like, you know, just a bit more reinforcement and stuff. It's still ridiculously light. It still weighs like, it weighs like 2 kilos.
Yeah.
So basically it's this small little thing, it's like 100
mm-hmm.
centimeters long. You know, it's kind of got these runners in the bottom.
Nice.
And yeah, it's going to have most of my stuff in it. Like, this isn't an unsupported endeavor. Like, when I went across Lake Baikal, I had 60 kgs in the sled. It was,
yeah.
it was ridiculous. Like,
that's huge.
I'll give people a bit of background. I keep forgetting we're actually recording a podcast here. I crossed Lake Baikal in Siberia on foot. It was a 700 kilometer trek, on the frozen lake. It's the deepest, biggest, deepest freshwater lake in the world. Freezes over in winter, and I did that there a couple of years ago. So yeah, that was a kind of solo expedition where I did it unsupported. So I had everything with me. This is a bit different. I'm trying to utilize
the resources.
Yeah, so basically get food where I can. Also, I'm going to have drop bags along the way.
Nice.
So like, the race kind of provides support for the first half, and then you're kind of on your own after that.
Yeah.
So basically what you do is you have your drop bags, and they have them ready at these towns and villages, and you know, you can get your extra food and fuel and things like that there. But beyond that, you have to mail your stuff ahead to the
yeah.
post offices.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, you got, it's really cool. US Postal
yeah.
is really cool service. You know, we've got like a parcel motel here.
Yeah, yeah.
They do that essentially in the post office.
Part of it, like,
yeah,
it's
part
yeah,
of the
yeah.
post office. So if you mail a package to yourself,
yeah.
which you can do, or to somebody, it'll be held in the post office just in the background.
So good.
And then you just can go and collect it. If you don't collect it within 30 days, it gets sent back to where it came from.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, it's a no-brainer. Yeah, it's a complete no-brainer. So what I do, I'm going over a couple of weeks beforehand. Mm-hmm. I'll do up my little parcels, send them, I'll probably be in California first, or I don't know, I might do it from an Anchorage, but like send them ahead to these villages.
Organized, yeah.
And then I'll have them available. And then if I don't get them, because obviously you got to think in terms of if I arrive into a village at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Exactly, yeah. How logistically.
Yeah, I got to hang around for 14 hours. I'm trying to cover, my ideal thing is to cover 67 kilometers a day. That's going to take more than 12 hours, close enough to 12 hours. So I can't be. Mm. So basically, the idea is that I have enough on me, and I try and make good decisions, around when I arrive into places. Maybe I can bypass a certain town and know that I'll get something in the next town. You know what I mean? Mm. So yeah, there's a lot there.
Awesome. So that's pretty good. Couple of things to finish. What are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading at the moment? I'm reading Lonely Planet, Alaska.
I love it.
And I've also got Mike Horn's book. He is probably the world's most prolific explorer.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't started it. He did a circumnavigation of the Arctic. So he went by sailboat and foot and ski around the whole perimeter of the Arctic, so up across the north coast of Russia, sailed across the Arctic to Greenland, crossed Greenland, sailed through the Northwest Passage to Alaska, crossed a bunch of Alaska, and then I think he might have walked on the ice across the Bering Sea to Russia. It was a huge expedition. He's done some insane things. He has a sailboat, so I'm I'm dipping into that now. I want to get through that. I don't read a hell of a lot. I'm more of a audiobooks guy, and podcasts. I'm mad for my podcasts. I literally have to listen to a podcast going to sleep now.
Just that gentle sound of the voice. Just,
otherwise I'm fidgeting, wanting to be on my phone playing Words of Friends or looking at the price of Bitcoin or something like that.
So we're going to talk about blockchain in another podcast. Not at the moment though.
Buy Bitcoin, kids. It's the future.
The next thing, the final one, I suppose, for solo adventurers or solo trainees or people who like exercising on their own or like doing stuff on their own, have you a couple of recommendations, be process driven? What have you got? Or what has worked really well for you? Is that self-awareness mentality to go towards, or trying to build that a bit, that would build that resilience?
Yeah, so one of the things that people always say to me, about training for the Arctic and stuff like that, it's you don't get those conditions in Ireland, and that's kind of a really valid point. It's not really cold here, into the minus whatever 20s and 30s, But I think that Ireland is the building block or the building place for real tough resilience. And there's a lot of people out there living it day to day by going out and training in the shitty weather we have, People are cycling, people are running and stuff like that, So I have this kind of thing that I use, and it was this mental kind of thing. And it was around the Yukon Arctic Ultra that I did a couple of years ago that I kind of got this idea. And it was when I went over there was this I had planned for the temperature to be around minus 20. So you've got it's fucking cold basically.
Yeah.
But it could have been minus 50 and it could have been zero. So there was a 50 degree
change
in temperature. And it's quite insane when you think about it.
It's massive, absolutely insane.
And that could have happened before I got there. It could have happened while I was racing over the space of 5 days.
Could have.
Yeah, exactly. So you just so the weeks beforehand, I'm looking at the weather. I'm thinking oh my God, is it going to be minus 50? Is it going to be zero? Do I need to bring some wet weather gear, or do I need to just stick with all the super cold, extreme cold stuff? And I just came to this kind of conclusion this idea, this mantra that came into my head, the conditions are perfect for you. And that's kind of something that I've been using kind of in everything I've done. And I think people can really use that in their daily lives, because you know, the whole idea that that comes from is that, like, you know, this thing that, like, a scientist talk about, that, like, conditions are perfect for human life. Like, we're the exact, on Earth, like, we're the exact kind of distance from the sun. You know, we've got the perfect amount of gravity, like, there's whatever amount of water, like, not able to back it up in any, whatever, any science, real science. But, like, yeah, that they say, you know, you've heard they said the conditions are perfect. So, like, why aren't the conditions perfect for you in your daily life, in the endeavors that you're doing? Well, they are. They're absolutely fucking perfect. But you don't think they're perfect. You're like, oh no, it's fucking raining, I can't do that. Oh, like, you know what I mean? There's always an excuse, you know, like, I'm not going to go make people watch, you know, videos of people with one arm doing stuff that. What I'm going to say is that, like, you know, just a simple thing, that, you know, the conditions are perfect for you in your life every day. Like, and that's how I view my daily grind when I'm on the Atlantic, you know, and that's, like, that's part acceptance of, like, the environment. Like, that's just something you do not have control over. Like, so you just have to, and that you just have to say, like, I am right for this environment. I am perfect for this environment. These conditions are perfect for me. And that's, I had to say that, like, pretty much every day in the Atlantic, like, those conditions I spoke about a few minutes ago with the convoluted sea, like, you know, like I was kind of saying, the fucking conditions are perfect for me. Yeah. You know, I was struggling with it then.
Through grit of teeth.
Yeah, through grit of teeth. But, like, they were, like, as in, you know, they were, that's what they were in that
moment. For that time. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what it was like when I go to Alaska, like, the conditions are going to be perfect for me then. Like, you know, be it, like, they're going to be a bit warmer, be it super, super cold. So, like, just having that sort of mentality, like, going into everything that you do, you know, be it sort of, like, you know, it'll just get you out the door, I think. You know what I mean? To do stuff, you know, get you into training, I think. Yeah.
I think that's a huge one, like, just to get that that basic mentality to try and get that positive reinforcement that you are able to. You have, the conditions are there. You just have to take the first step.
Just accept them. Just accept it.
Just accept it. It's like like that. The environment is, it's like you have only, it's, I suppose it goes back to the old controlled controllables, but, like, very much a case of, if you rather than listen, you start talking to yourself better.
Yeah.
You improve your actual your own language with yourself. Like, fix that language.
Yeah.
Quickly, rather than just kind of, like, it's not even necessarily swearing or anything like that. It's something simple like that. It's a case of, no, speak with purpose to yourself.
Yeah.
And you will be able to find out an awful lot more comfortable ability in yourself than if you are starting to talk with a little bit of doubt or a bit of meekness in your voice.
Yeah.
Like, start with, give yourself, like, you have a strong voice, use it to talk to yourself sternly.
Yeah.
And you'll make a good bit of progress.
No, totally. Like, I mean, it's, like, I'm big on that sort of idea, and I'm big on just, you know, not being cynical of you know, just having a sort of
there's enough cynical
and it's just to try, and I try and stay away from people who are like that, people who complain and moan about things, you know what I mean? I just want to be around people who aren't gonna you know, sort of
get super negative,
really, or really question what I'm actually doing in my life.
Yeah.
You don't know, but you know what I mean? Like, so just it all ties in to that stuff as well. Like, it's super important, I think, you know. So
Well, Gavin, we're going to leave it there. That was pretty epic. The next one, I'm sure, will be very epic.
We'll talk about blockchain.
We'll talk about blockchain, absolutely. We'll definitely talk about blockchain. How much Bitcoin actually Gavin has. He'll bring a Bitcoin into the studio. Into the studio, exactly. I'm going to link up all the bits and pieces. We talked about a lot there, guys. The best thing to do is to check out Gavin on the internet somewhere.
Solo Gav, SOULOGAV.
.com.
That's my Twitter.
That's his Twitter and Instagram name.
Twitter and Instagram. It's just GavinHennigan.com. There's not very many Gavin Hennigan, so it's easy enough to find me. So yeah, look, I'm on all the usual things.
Bits and pieces.
Hopefully I'll have a tracker when I'm in Alaska, and I've got a Garmin inReach, so I'll be able to update Twitter, Facebook, and stuff. So I'll be able to hopefully update as I go across Alaska. So definitely worth tracking me out there. It'll be in February the 19th that starts. So
super stuff, Gavin. I'll link all of those up. Yeah, Gavin, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. But
awesome.
We're gonna leave it there, guys, and hopefully you enjoyed the show.
Thanks. See ya.
Bye.